He did his undergrad and PhDs in physics at Oxford, on Everett's public state interpretation, and then he switched to philosophy, with an enviable academic career, and also at Oxford, with his master's degree on the role of probability in linguistic interpretation. And are you now currently doing PhD in philosophy?
Yes.
So we have a we're a preeminent expert on many worlds to be describing the interpretation of these, so we're happy to do it.
Okay, sort of preliminary point. I think if you come to the interpretation of quantum mechanics, then the way it sort of looks at first sight is, okay, you've got this whole bunch of possible ways of interpreting quantum mechanics. They also have advantages and disadvantages. Oh, plus it's this completely mad one that says the universe contains two different properties. So I think a difficulty in presenting the Everett interpretation to any group that's relatively new to interpretation, particularly if you see it as the first thing you see, is it can seem the sort of sheer insanity of the interpretation, which is obviously fairly weird, can just seem to make it rather a waste of time to consider it in the first place. So, before the bulk of the talk, I'd like to say a little bit to sort of motivate what led people like Everett in the 50s to take seriously the many worlds idea and to sort of get a feel for why we might want to take it seriously as a possibility, not obviously as the only way to understand quantum mechanics, but as a contender. So, let's just review old ground very quickly. Measurement problem, which we'll get in all the next 2 weeks. Before the measurement, we have some superposition of microscopic states. So it's I'm just going to use spin states right through, for example. So I've got a system that's in some superposition of spin up and spin down, and I've got a measurement device that hasn't looked at it yet. So this thing is some sort of weird quantum state. Well, that's okay, because the microscopic world is actually weird. In some particles don't have definite values of spin. Well, okay, fair enough, that's a bit strange, but who requires an actual microscopic world to be strange? We are slow-moving, large organisms whose tuitions evolved to handle a quasi-classical world. So there's no guarantee that we can have a story to tell about what the microscopic world is like. So it's just a superposition. And then we measure it, and we crank out the dynamics of our theory. This is the dynamics that work perfectly well at microscopic level. And we find that dynamics seems to predict state of something like this. So now the superposition says it's not just a superposition of some spin particle in that state, it's also a superposition of some measuring device in a measures up and measures down state. Now that's starting to get a bit stranger. And of course, what the normal interpretation of that would be is that the physical state may seem to be this superposition according to the formalism, but actually it isn't. It's either this thing, or it's that thing, and it's this thing with one probability and that thing another probability, and we don't know which, and that thing there can be read as simply telling us that we don't know which, and somehow to be read as some sort of statistical probability. And that's particularly true if you, if you go to a reduced formalism and you look at the density operator associated with that post-measurement state, that object is very nice interpretation of saying not here is some weird entangled thing, but here is this thing or that thing or the other thing, we don't know which. This mathematical object is just coding the probabilities of it being one of these innocuous classical states. Okay. But of course that is a problem. What is this damn state? Because, as I say, before the measurement it seems to have one state, after it seems to have another state. And if you think about the way we use language of states in physics, then basically the state of a system, generally speaking, means one of two things. Normally speaking, it means something like the actual physical state of the system. What's really there, if you want to wax philosophical. In electromagnetism, the state of the system means the electric and magnetic field that make the charges. And that's meant to say, that's your sort of complete description of the world. And in Newtonian physics, say, you might have your pointing configuration space, the state of the system, because it corresponds to the positions of all the particles. And that's all you need to do to say what's physically going on in Newtonian physics. And of course, there's an alternative sort of notion of state, which comes out of statistical mechanics, where a state is not some physical description of what's going on. It's rather some sort of probabilistic description of what's going on. So it's saying something like, well, it's inconvenient or unnecessarily complicated to say exactly what the state is. We're going to say it's this one or this one or this one or this one. We're not sure which. And we're going to consider the dynamics of this probability distribution. But the real situation is something else. And this probability distribution is in principle dispensable. You could do statistical mechanics just using the microdynamics of the individual, of the actual location of all the atoms in the container of gases. In practice, it would be completely impossible, but Eel trees are logically possible. So that's a different notion of state. And of course, the problem is that the quantum state doesn't seem to be one thing or the other. So before the measurement, it seems that we actually have got some description of the physical state. And there are lots of reasons why we might want to say that, but reasons we can challenge it, but sort of just to remind yourselves of it, if you consider a spin half particle and you say, well, it's in superpositions up and down, well, any superpositions up and down according to one basis is definitely pointing along some other basis. So it doesn't seem the natural thing to do, not necessarily the only thing to do, but the natural thing to do when we're considering the microscopic state is to think of it in the former sense, as some sort of physical description of reality. And then it seems after measurement, we're compelled to treat it the other way and to say it's a probabilistic state. This thing is not really describing reality one-to-one. It's somehow summing up some probabilistic states about reality, and what's really going on is that thing or that thing. And if we knew which of those we had, we could throw this thing away. This is what I think is called phase selection. To carry on using this thing after measurement, so the theory is to say, is just a way of stating, well, we don't actually know the answer yet. We haven't actually looked. We've done the experiment, we haven't walked into the lab and seen the result. But if we did, we could get it.
With that sum, do you actually mean a coherent superposition, or do you mean how much?
Well, I sort of mean both. What I want to mention is that measure I actually is going to include a macroscopic description of effectively the whole lab, fairly roughly the whole universe. So mixed into that measure I is a huge amount of environmental degrees of freedom. In practice, we can't see those, so we trace over them, and when we get that, we get a mixed state. But you know, mathematically, it does the ordinary unitary dynamics, the same thing's going on. Okay, so that's a bit of a problem, because it's presumably got to be one thing or the other, or if somehow we've got to move from one script to another, we better have a rule to say how we move from one thing to the other. And that's a way of putting the measure problem, and hopefully all this is on hand. So what could we do about it? Well, we could say, yes, the damn state's always physical. That thing would have to be physical, but we don't see weird indefinite measurement outcomes, so we're going to have to change the theory. And there are some very serious contenders to interpretation of quantum mechanics on the table which do exactly that. You might change the theory by adding some sort of extra hidden variables that go along with quantum state, so that even though the quantum state theory is in a superposition like that, there's some way in which what's really going on, what we observe in measurements, however you want to put it, corresponds not just to the physical state, but also to some hidden variable. The hidden variable says, actually, it reads a measure up, or it reads a measure down, or something. Or you might say, that state just doesn't happen because the dynamics is wrong. You say we have unit dynamics, that's fine, that's hunky-dory for microscopic systems. When you get to the macroscopic level, it stops being unitary, the dynamics gets nonlinear in some way, it gets probabilistic in some way, and instead of getting this thing, you get one or the other. And those two approaches have led primarily, respectively, to the De Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory and the GFL theory. Or alternately, you might say, okay, it's not just it's always physical, it's not just not always physical, it's never physical. It really is a probabilistic state, like it's that mech. And then we're going to have to construct a new theory where we can say what it's a probabilistic description of. So maybe we have a hidden variable theory of some sort, and according to this hidden variable theory, then somehow epistemically, in practice, when we don't know the values of the hidden variables, it's helpful to use this wave function. But in principle, we can throw it out completely and just use the hidden variable. Now, both of those strategies are research programs. They're serious, well-motivated research programs, and it's not a criticism of the research programs, but they're research programs. They are ideas of how we could replace quantum mechanics with a theory that works better. We have chunks of them. We know rather more about the approaches that treat the state as physical than we do about the ones that treat the state as probabilistic. But they're basically programs that are committed to effectively redoing our sort of programming philosophy. So in principle, starting with algorithmic quantum mechanics, working out theories there, generalizing those theories to cover algorithmic particle mechanics, free field quantum electrodynamics, moving on to a full redone version of our quantum field theory or something, which doesn't have these problems in. We're nowhere near, but there are interesting vectors going. Okay, but you might want to say, I'm not very happy about this. I don't want to redefine metaphysics. It seems to work really well. I don't want to be committed to having to essentially reconstruct a theory that has whatever its conceptual problems has a hell of a lot of different success. Well, we don't want to do that. Then we have to meet a theory that fits. We have to have a theory that fits A and B. So we have to say the wave function description is complete, or at any rate, we've got to say we can't complete the wave function description further. There's nothing. When we use the wave function to describe physics, we didn't leave anything out. And you've also got to say it always evolves in those terms. It never collapses. It's, so it really does evolve into these conditions. Okay. That leads you to the other two possibilities I mentioned. First of which is we could say the wave function is a probabilistic state, it is like in StatNet, but there isn't any underlying reality underneath it. Now, also on the interpretations, like such ones with Lefty Balance, as we'll talk about later, of course, fit that pattern. One way of taking the sort of classic Kevin-Hagen interpretations like that, one way of taking some of the ideas that come out of sort of information theory ideas in quantum mechanics, like some of the things that Chris Luke put, something like that. Does it make sense to say the wave function is a probabilistic entity, but it's not underlain by some sort of real physical state of which it sets the probabilities off? I've never been able to understand how to make sense of that. Others say they can make sense of it. I leave it to you to think about.
Like this
happened, I don't think unless we agree with assuming
assumption A there,
the wave function is possible.
That's argued by the
expansion. Yeah, sure. So I mean, the notional worry is either the wave function is a probabilistic description and it's not incomplete, and in that case you think there's something else underneath it, or somehow there isn't something else underneath it, and it's not sure what to do. And I'm no expert in the ensemble interpretation, and there may well be good answers to that. But that's a sort of prime case of worry. Okay, and if you share that worry, and it's not resolved for you later in the course, then the remaining option for you is the Evans interpretation. The Evans interpretation says the quantum state is a physical state. It's not a probabilistic thing, it's not an ensemble or something else, it doesn't say what we're reading about. It's just as physical as something like an electromagnetic field or the Klein-Dorn field, or any other sort of physical entities that theoretical physics can throw at its brains. Secondly, it completely describes reality. We didn't leave anything out. When we said the universe is in state psi, we've now said everything there is to say about the universe. We don't have to say some additional stuff about it's in state psi, and in addition, there are some hidden variables here and some hidden variables here. We don't have anything else to add. And the dynamics are unitary. The dynamics are just given by the Hamiltonians of whatever our best quantum theory is, without any modification whatsoever. And that's a complete description from a physical point of view of the Evans interpretation.
I just have a quick question. For those who think that the quantum state is not physical, but can just be sort of a probability distribution. Mm-hmm. We know from experiment that those probabilities can be complex, negative, whatever. So do they think that it's still unphysical with negative probability or complex probabilities? How do you explain that?
What I think they'll say is that, and I know you've been confused, so this may be a very unfair comment, but to be as fair as I can, what I think they want to say is it's not that the amplitudes that correspond to the probabilities, it's always the mod squared amplitude, which always are positive. And the amplitude information is sort of somehow encoding the fact that we can make a lot of measurements with a lot of different bases. So you might imagine, say I consider measurements in position and in momentum. What they're going to say is something like, we could give you a long list of probabilities of all the possible position measurements, and we could give you a long list of all the probabilities of all possible momentum measurements. But it so happens there's a mathematical object which at once encodes all the possible probability measurements and momentum measurements. And furthermore, you can't just suppose any old probability of momentum probabilities, position of momentum probabilities, like you could in, say, classical statistical mechanics. There are a lot of constraints between what possible position probabilities and momentum probabilities there are, and those constraints are encoded in the fact that God represented by away from, so at least got for today's separator. I think that's the sort of answer they want to know. Does anyone who's maybe better on the kind of that?
You could also, instead of writing as a wave function, you could write the density operator in a basis of operators, and in that basis of operators, all the weights are positive. They can interpret those as probability. There's lots of ways, mathematical ways of representing the same object. And some of those representations, you just get a list of positive numbers. They can say those are the things that I'm going to interpret as probabilities.
Having said which, I mean, to drop off the attempt to be as nice as possible representation. while you've been formulated, we know there are interference of things in quantum mechanics. There's at least a danger where you want to say, well, look, in my experiment, if I want to interpret this thing probabilistically, the inclination is the same, say, a two-slit experiment. There's some probability of the electron being here and some probability of the electron being there. And we know that can't be true in a naive sense, because we know that the probability of the electron turning up here is not the sum of the probability of this electron turning up here plus probability of this electron turning up here. We know that the branch is going to be here. So there are certainly questions to answer. It's not a simple resolution, but it's not a sort of simple knockdown either. Okay, so what I'm saying really is that the Edward interpretation, in terms of, if you want to sort of give the literal positive for the Edward interpretation, in the same way as you might give the literal positive for some class thing, then in a sense the literal positives for the interpretation are simply the rules of quantum. Nothing is added on. We are just completely literalist about the theory. We interpret it in the same naive way we interpret some sort of field theory. In other words, in a field theory, we say the field is just the literal description of the world. In the Edward interpretation, we say the quantum state is just the literal description of the world, and it always evolves according to the equations. Quantum mechanics, they're not wrong. And of course, that's going to lead us to a lot of problems and a lot of things that are going to happen. But what I'm hoping to motivate here is what the appeal of trying to handle those paradoxes are. Because if you want to suppose that we're going to interpret quantum mechanics as it is and take advantage as they are of all the successes we've had to build so far, rather than commit ourselves to a research program or to some extent redoing or reformulating it, and if you don't find the idea of treating it just as some sort of probabilistic distribution without anything underlying it as a coherent idea, then you're more or less pushed to the interpretation. It's on the table as the only pure interpretation, the only interpretation without modification, that's also what, as a philosopher, you would say, really, it's also trying to set the theory simply described reality. So that's the appeal. But the disadvantage, of course, is that it poses an absurdly large and impossible universe that we'll cover today. Okay. The thing is, how can this make sense? This is going to connect to why this thing gets called a many worlds. Because look, here seems to be a two-line knockdown argument against the theory. Point one, the theory says experiments have indefinite outcomes. Point two, experiments don't have indefinite outcomes. Have you ever met an experimenter who says, well, I measure the superposition of being spin up, I'm getting results up, and the superposition of being spin up, getting results up down. So there seems to be just a straightforward contradiction going on. And the. And a central insight that goes into trying to understand how the Edward interpretation is made to work is that a state like this, where we have a superposition of I made a spin up plus I made a spin down, is somehow correctly understood as describing two worlds, or two, possibly two sets of worlds. And the world, these worlds are isolated, or they're nearly isolated chunks of reality. In each one, things occur approximately in a classical way, and in one of the worlds we get the up result, and in the other world we get the down result. Hence the many worlds interpretation. There's a literature point to be careful with. Many worlds interpretation, and some say Edward interpretation, get used differently by different people arguing for it. I don't think this is quite as true as it used to be, but to some extent it's still true to say that there are many versions of the Edward interpretation as there are people who think it's true. Sometimes a many worlds theory will mean something different. It will mean the Edward interpretation plus some extra structure to do on self worlds. For that reason, I'm not going to use the terminology here. We could talk about Everett interpretation. I'll just mean that literalist reading of the quantum mechanics. But other people use the terminology differently. Okay, now there is a problem with that. Here are some of the big ones. Firstly, well, why does it make sense to call this thing after worlds? It's one state field of space. Okay, it's keeping you actually down to that superposition, but what makes it not? Secondly, and I'm not going to talk about set voice so much, quite a philosophical problem, how does it make sense to think about our own existence in such a world? How can it make sense to suppose that, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm about to make an experiment, how does it make sense for me to expect that after the experiment I'll be duplicating to other problems? And this, is all, this third one has always been seen as the most serious problem by most commentators. How does probability make sense in this thing? Because normally speaking, physical theories which have probability normally comes from one of two places. Either it comes from dynamics, that dynamics are somehow stochastic, you could know the entire time to save the world, but that does not fit the future, or somehow they come from ignorance. If only we knew that we'll save the world, then we wouldn't have any probability, but we don't, so we do get probability. So in particular, if you look at other interpretations of quantum mechanics, the collapse theories, like the DOW theory, bring in probability by the first method, and the pilot wave of the Bode theory brings in by the second method, just like this. But in the Everett interpretation, that's not an option. In the thing's deterministic, we've got it's unitary dynamics all the way down, and furthermore, in principle, we can know everything, or at least we can know all the salient facts before a measurement. We can actually know what the post-measurement quantum state would be, so where is the space to understand the theory problems? And it seems there must be. In fact, yes, forget it seems to us, there actually must be a way to understand the probabilistically, at least in some sense, because we see the fact that quantum mechanics predicts probabilities is as old as the theory itself. So, what I want to do for the rest of today is essentially address the first problem and start with the second problem. And what I'm going to spend most of Thursday's lecture doing is talking about the third problem of probability. And I'm also going to talk a little bit on Thursday about the unlocality of the interpretation, because it's going to come up from Easy Mountain, gives introductory talks, and the situation, the extent to which quantum mechanics is or isn't local in the Everett interpretation is quite complicated. And just to give some think about before coming back to that, have a look if you have a chance at the premises going into the Benjamin College to see if they apply to the Everett interpretation. I didn't watch all, because I didn't have the time.
23.
Great. Does anyone want to ask anything sort of general about that before I get on to it?
The second thing. So you're just assuming that whenever we make a measurement, we're actually splitting into two worlds. These worlds don't already exist.
This is one way of reading this is something turns up, this is a parallel universe theory, so there's two of me before the measurement, and then it turns out one of them gets the upper result and one of them gets the down result. So that's not how I'm describing it. I mean, you can use that sort of picturesque way of talking to some extent, but no, the literal way is that there's one world that splits.
So if that happens, I just don't see how it seems like we give up conservation of energy if we keep on splitting and infinite many measurements, then we kind of get infinite energy, and it seems like we're giving that up.
Yeah, this happens a few times. You want to ask yourself what conservation of energy means. I mean, there's a certain very obvious literal way in which you're not giving up conservation of energy, which is the dynamics of the unitary, trivially, that would certainly be the energy of the same thing. So in a technical sense, energy certainly is conserved. So any of our reasons for sort of thinking it as being conserved from sort of things like, you know, nerve-type arguments are kind of perfectly safe. Furthermore, if we measure to be conserved, because if currently we're in an ideal state of energy, then there isn't any mechanism where one graph is going to a higher energy state and one would be lower energy state. If you want to ask still intuitively doesn't that seem to violate conservation of energy, then you want to ask yourself why. Because you can imagine basically, before the measurement test meeting, and I measure the amount of energy in the whole universe is 10 gazillion joules. And then after the split, I've got two successors, and the one who gets spin up measures 10 gazillion joules, and the one who gets spin down. Okay, but now forget that. Think about a classical universe. And in the classical universe, suppose I measure the amount of energy in the universe. Think of my progression through space patterns. And look at the chunk of matter that is me at 10 o'clock, and the chunk of matter that's me at 11 o'clock. And the chunk of matter that's me at 10 o'clock measures the amount of energy in the universe and finds it's 10 gazillion joules. The chunk of matter that's me at 11 o'clock also measures the amount of energy in the universe and also finds it's 10 gazillion joules. And we don't, to work out the whole energy of the universe, we don't add them up and say total energy 20 gazillion joules. Because energy is not just not the sort of thing that you add up between times. Why not read off of the maths? And similarly, energy is just not the sort of thing that you can sum by looking at the energy in one branch, the energy in another branch down together. Again, why read off of the maths?
How are they real in that case? Mm-hmm. What's
So, how real are the different outcomes? So they're not there at the same time.
Oh, I'm sorry, my time thing is an analogy, it's not meant to be a...
That's right, right. So I'm trying to see if that analogy really works. Does it? Is it the same thing? Because in the quantum mechanical many works version, in principle, U up and U down is at the same time. In that case, I'm allowed to add theta.
I think they're not. As I say, when you put it this way, you can add it up, but why would you expect that quantity to be conserved? The only reason you'd expect it to be conserved is that quantity to be equal. The only reason you expect it to be equal is because you've got a theory of conservation of energy that says, presumably says something like the total energy in the universe is the sum of the energy in each branch. And that's just not true. You can see from that it's not true.
Why wouldn't
that
be
the
Gauss idea and look at this evolving thing from outside? Mm-hmm. Then the energy is not conserved.
Well, you can take that view. And if God looks at it from outside and says, look, there's two branches, and this branch is 10 billion joules, this branch is 10 billion joules, I'm going to consider the quantity of the sum of those two branches, then he's going to get a quantity that's not conserved. But why should he be interested in that quantity? It doesn't correspond to energy because it doesn't correspond to how much energy.
No, we try to understand the world, right? So if you don't look just at one branch, because your quantum mechanical state is everything. Mm-hmm. You have to look at everything.
Absolutely.
If you look at just one branch and say, here, things are conserved. And maybe they are not enough because you might measure energy, and actual energy is not conserved. If you then collapse to some eigenstate, you lose that.
Well, what makes you think that energy is the sort of thing that we have about two branches? You've got to have a claim that says, okay, I've got two branches, and there's some energy in the world, if the energy of this branch plus the energy of this branch. Energy, and that's just not going to be true. Energy is not the sort of thing that you can say is additive across branches. It doesn't have that mathematical properties.
No, my argument is very simple. The quantum mechanical state describes the whole universe, not a particular branch.
Yep.
So I want to apply my conservation laws to this whole quantum mechanical state. And you take the Hamiltonian, it evolves with the Hamiltonian, and you have your conservation relationship, you have the conservation of energy.
Absolutely.
For the whole universe,
yep.
All the branches.
Yep.
So that means that I cannot use your interpretation. You say these branches are, I don't understand what's the reality of the branches.
The branches have attributes, do they not?
They do.
So, if you will.
Not all branches are equal. Not all of them are not one.
Okay.
So,
does this not mean that it's not like 10 gazillion joules plus 10 gazillion joules? Does that make it alpha squared times 10 gazillion joules plus beta squared times 10 gazillion joules?
Yeah, that's the example.
You selected the computational basis for a Mizanov state definition. How does the theory change after that? He was like,
there's an easy answer and a hard answer. The easy answer is the computational basis was chosen because I set up a measure device that measured on the basis. I could have chosen bit x and y. The hard answer is how can I use that particular basis to decompose and get words? I can move on to that.
At the end of the experiment, you got one answer.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the other individuals?
Somebody else got that answer. The other version of you got that answer. This is probably an unfair order.
Would it be possible after measurement to do another measurement and merge those two worlds back together, like look up some kind of Hamiltonian that merge them back together?
Only if you're gone. Basically, in practice, and this is going to be important, we'll come on to it, just to preview, as soon as you get the experiment on something like this macroscopic scale, then it's going to start getting entangled with the environment at a very rapid speed, and entangled with the outer light speed. So the only way you could bring them together is to do an interference experiment on a sort of box that contains everything going out from the system, and somehow be ingenious enough to interfere this sort of vast macroscopic system to bring them back together. So there'll be a Hamiltonian who can do it, but no sort of realizable finite theory can ever operate it.
Are these ongoing splittings and resplittings continuous or stochastic process?
I don't suppose it's being in opposition. Do you mean are they discrete?
Yeah, is there a discrete unit of time or unit of whatever it is where there's a split that can occur here and then another split can appear here and another split can appear here? Or is it just willy-nilly whenever we want to split?
It depends on the physics of what. Okay, it depends on the physics of whatever process is inducing the splitting, but can I come back to that once I've
sure. Heard
it? That's going to be a bit clearer in a minute, I think.
Okay.
I'm going to take one more question, thank you.
Right.
You suggested that the assumptions you made coming out of it fail literally to
lead you very naturally to this, but I want to suggest that if you're assuming that you're in a collapsed high state rather than some mixture state, and I don't know if I consider that at all or look at that, but it seems to me to be, there's not a good reason to believe that I was only one of you worlds, was all of those in the situation. Why would I say right now in one state rather than two?
I think there is an answer here, but I haven't given it yet. That's the next. That's basically the rest of the staff. That's a good question. Go ahead.
Well, this splitting, in some sense, comes in the analog of replacement of wave function collapse and some other interpretations. We know that that typically has difficulties with Lorentz invariance. It brings in new problems. Have you purposely avoided, I mean, are those problems not there?
Well, in a certain sense,
are you just avoiding them, or what's the state?
Well, in a certain sense, we're going to solve it. We're going to feel guaranteed advance we're going to solve this problem because we've assumed in advance that we're just taking the covariant quantum mechanics. So, in a sense, if in solving some of this stuff, we put ourselves in a position where we're threatened by immense variance, then we've already broken the assumption of just taking the theory literally. If we stick to that, we should be safe. How concrete will we say, can we come back to it? Because I think...
No, but I'm saying there'll be some frame dependence of the world or something like that. That's a new thing to me.
Yeah, well, the short answer is going to be that the division of the world into the division of the state of the world is effectively going to be a length process. For ourselves in a lab, we could, and ourselves in an Earth that's so lost, we could, if we wanted to, regard the whole universe being split. There's really just a forward life here. Okay, I think I'm going to have to go off time. So this has been coming up quite a lot of evidence, so it's really useful. The first question I want to address, the question I'm going to spend most of the day addressing, is going to be what defines this world? What makes this world sort of valid? How do we see these worlds in the modern wave function? So, it doesn't matter. Okay, so we've got some quantum state like this, the amplitude is vector, but it's a superposition of C spin after C spin. And the theory is claiming that something this is meant to be shorthand for data field calculation with DC spins up, spin after you report to the physical review, everyone meets the whole universe gets left out, and spin down likewise. So then we want to say, well, what makes those states the worlds? And in one way of putting it, which is the position that's within the literature, is why not these things? Why not consider this superposition of the world and this superposition of the world? And you could take any arbitrary superposition. But of course, if this thing is a world, then macroscopic properties like what the result of the measurement is, my quantum state, are not definite even within a world. And that's the problem we were trying to solve in the first place. Remember the reason why we said we can't take the literal physical reading of the post-measurement state is that C have these definite outcomes. So if there are definite outcomes even within a world, then the whole thing is a waste of time. And that problem in the literature is called the preferred basis problem. I am meant to be basically one basis seems to be preferred to pick out what the worlds are, which basis is it. Now, there's been a general consensus in people who've been interested in it over the last 10 years as to what the answer should be. And there are problems with that answer, which I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about. But here's the consensus. Except anyone. Anyone like to offer a student's open? Anyone like to offer a guess as to what the preferred choice basis is?
Well, can all students understand this ambiguity that arises?
I still want to say it's not an ambiguity, but yeah, I understand.
Well, you want to say, just to check out, because I can only answer for another half hour, so it's better, but you want to say, how can I know all the branches of reference, what do we have?
What I want to say is that we don't have a good idea from the experience about what it would mean to be a superposition. Like, I have no reason to assume I'm this or that, or that macroscopic other, because I don't know what I am. It's problematic to say, well, I should see this, and I should see that, And because I'm a collapsed state, I have to interact with another collapsed state to form the essential part of the
function. Somewhere in the limitation depends. I'm guessing you've been doing this.
I don't really have a very well-developed view on this since I'm
maybe
not as experienced as
well, it's a bet.
Some of the people in comfort. But I don't see where anyone said. I know I'm a collapsed state because it's collapsed. I don't know what it would mean to be a mixed state interacting with another mixed state, but because I don't know what that means, I mean, maybe it means everyday normal experience.
Okay. So
I see nobody who says.
I'm going to keep that for a second. I'm going to check out the prop tonight. I'm sort of putting a hole in that. By the end of this, I should have finally announced it. But I like to put some stuff away. So, yeah.
We talk about preferred pages. The way I think about it, it's a dynamic approach. It's like you do a measurement, there's a unitary evolution, and this measurement is not that it sits room at this time and now the measurement is taking place. It's a slowly evolving state, and slowly the preferred base kind of evolves, and there's no way back at a certain point.
Yep.
It's a dynamical process.
Yep.
So that means that to call things, to name things, the measurements, is misleading. Because everything is called mechanically, the microscope system plus the measurement system, I can make microscopic measurement systems, or I can make them small so that they have quantum features.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it becomes a very gray area what makes the preferred basis. But you assign enormous power to your preferred basis, namely they partition the world in definite branches. So this goes. I have an issue with this continuity and this gray area where you don't know if something is measuring. And you can make them interfere, you wait longer and it cannot interfere. So it's just a dynamic
approach. Sure. Okay. I mean, I've just been off the position to answer that yet. I don't want to take general questions here for you, but I'm just interested if anyone wants to. Yeah.
Well, the collapse is the thing, I guess, what can the measurement be? You're going to be collapsing with your 90s, or not collapsing. The world's going to be divided based on 90 levels of the overhead. So if you're making a different measurement, you're going to need to do a splitting.
Yeah. What's that point? There are two points I can answer. One of them is that the physical world, the macroscopic world, seems to be certainly robust. We don't, in fact, we don't find that if we did a weird superposition of a particular interval sample or maybe this one not going to. The other problem is that measurement is not sort of what you might call a primitive physical process. We don't want John Bell's because we don't want a theory where measurement, the concept of measurement is entering into fundamental level. Okay, well I'm going to move on with this. The answer I was interested in to come up with is the basic test that you usually find is the one that gets picked out of an algebra of the inheritance process. This is a rhetorical question. So the deep inheritance basis, if you remember, is basically picked out by looking at which quantum states do and don't rapidly become entangled in the environment. It's basically picked out the basic states which become minimally entangled in the environment. And we have a lot of inconclusive reason to think that the inheritance process picks out, in sort of physically realistic situations, picks out a basis that is properly localized in the position of measurement. In other words, it picks out a basis of states that are sort of approximately classical in that sense. Okay, so suggestion, which I'm not making, why don't we solve the measurement problem by taking the limit of quantum mechanics and adding to it a postulate to the effect that the preferred basis is the basis picked out for the coherence process. In other words, worlds defined by the coherence.
Before you get to that point, what's the meaning of the partitioning problem, the state that you're in? How do you measure the probability that you're in your current branch? So you don't have any access to the others.
Yeah.
So how do you know what's out there? How would I check that?
I'm not touching code, I'll just say. Okay, in terms of why decoherence, hopefully people will know, to some extent it will come up, but in terms of what makes that move a mistake, there are lots of reasons.
I'm suggesting that there's an actual basis of the curve, in other words, complete set of vectors, or is it a subspace or a partial space?
Wait a second.
think David should continue, and don't be shy to shut up the older part of the audience. So, questions from the students are welcome, but the older people can wait until later on. That's a big, big mistake we think is coming up. And I'll be the referee. If you're too shy to do it.
Thank you. So, from the decoherence of the shots. Firstly, decoherence is vague, it's fuzzy. There's no way that the decoherence process says the preferred basis is actually this basis. It says it's this basis with a little bit of maybe you have this thing, maybe you have this thing. It's not exactly chosen. Secondly, it might be worse, it might actually be ambiguous. And by the difference between ambiguous and vague, I mean that something might be vague if we're not exactly sure which thing it is. Something might be ambiguous if it's either getting this thing or that thing. It could be either. And no one succeeded in finding any plausible, microscopically phrasable criterion for which R and R particular spaces. So, I mean, in the early 90s, it was sort of hoped that there'd be some nice, clean criteria you could write down that said, the Dickens basis is the basis according to which such and such functional of the operating basis vanishes, or its real part vanishes, or something like that. And it's been fairly clearly shown that if you try to trip like that, you will either exclude the sort of basis you're growing towards the classical one, or you'll include a whole lot of other stuff that's not remotely classical and yet it's not. And if you look at the way decoherence is done from a cosmological point of view these days, it tends to be that your criterion is going to be something like quasi-classicality. In other words, it's going to be a basis according to which you can form sort of quasi-classical dynamical laws within it. But that's obviously a sort of higher level notion. It's an emergent notion. It's not the sort of thing that you can phrase in terms of the microphysics. You can't say, it's not like saying the third basis is the decoherence basis is the one in which someone evolves from decoherent. That makes sense as a sort of property of the world, but it's not, that's not the sort of property that you want to have picture in your laws of physics. And thirdly, there's a point which I haven't brought up, but Raphael brings it up, which is the decoherence basis. If we want to specify a basis, then that seems to be producing unnecessary amounts of fine grain. Decoherence is inevitably a very coarse grain process because the third basis of the universe, and we only get at this damn thing by tracing out a whole lot of degrees we really don't care about. So any basis that's preferred by decoherence is a basis only in the sense that it's a sort of set of projectors that jointly partition space. It's not a set of unit projectors. So you can maybe say, well, look, it's this subspace, this subspace, this subspace, but not this vector. And most seriously, as I hope to say, it misses the point. We weren't looking for some way of adding extra laws and structure to our theory so as to create a new physical theory. We could look for such a thing, but if we weren't looking for such a thing, then it might be a good start one, which doesn't suppose the universe would take to stop as a methodological suggestion. The thing that makes it worth looking for a version of the interpretation is the possibility that we don't need to do that. So, if that's the case, what would you do? Well, if decoherence is the thing that defines the preferred basis, we need not to stipulate that it is, but we need to prove that it is, to argue that it is plausible that it is. In other words, we need somehow to say that a state which is under non-decoherence is already correctly described as an ensemble of worlds. In other words, if not that we stipulate that it is and use decoherence as a basis for our stipulation, but we're saying it already is. Okay, that may make sense. So to try to cash out what I mean, what are we actually trying to say when we say this thing is an ensemble of worlds? Well, what's a world? It's basically supposed to be the sort of macroscopic surround we know and love. It needs to be something in which there exist macroscopic everyday objects, tables, chairs, people, Coke cans, Sprite cans, doing the sort of macroscopic things we're sort of classical things we're using. So this question becomes really an example of a more general problem. What are the criteria by which we say that some amount of micro stuff is really some amount of macro stuff? When do we say that some collection of atoms or collection of subatomic particles or some collection of field excitation values is really a goldfish? So, to present a potential way of understanding the answer to that question, here's an example of something which we generally agree to be a macroscopic robust existence. Suppose we want to understand these times. We want to understand, we're interested in understanding, maybe we want to
tell us far we park, or maybe we just need to make this in a cube if we want, for whatever reason, we want to understand tigers. And we want to understand tigers and their surroundings and their lifestyles, their cultures and stuff. Here are some ways of studying hunting patterns for tigers. Strategy one. Well, a tiger, a forest full of tigers is just a big, complicated physical system. It can't have more than 10 to 35, 10 to 36 atoms and electrons in. It's finitely many equations, let's just solve them. Okay, that's clear. It's the same for two reasons. The less important reason is that it's completely impossible. I mean, there's clearly no computer in the world that can solve it. I mean, is there doing another problem, of course, is that in principle, those equations with quantum mechanics which we have to measure the problem. But ignore that. Suppose that there's no quantum splitting in this situation. So we've got some set of molecular dynamical equations. There is clearly no way any computer in the world can come close to actually solving the simultaneous 10-35 simultaneous set of equations for all the atoms in some even relatively small area of some micrometer hunting park. And it's pretty clear that it's not even in the remote future we'd like to have such a. But suppose, for the sake of argument, we did. It's the new Pentium 5 sitting on my desk, and it calculates the answers. Even if it did the calculation for us, the calculation is vastly too complex to be surveyable by here. We won't understand it at all. It will say it prints out and print out a massive paper somewhere with like suspect the volume of Jupiter, and it's not that I'm underestimating, detailing all William Green's steps of calculations. And we won't understand at all what's going on the consequence. The computer will admittedly give us a description of the hunting park and the tiger in 10 minutes' time. And if we want to know the state of the tiger in 10 minutes' time, then that's very useful. But we already have a perfectly good device which can be used to calculate the state of the tiger in 10 minutes' time. It's called a timer. What we're after in this situation is not primarily prediction, it's explanation. So what can we do? Well, we could look at this swirl of atoms and molecules. We could identify in that swirl certain robust high-level structures which obey their own robust high-level laws and theories and so on, where the obedience of these is not absolutely perfect, not 100%, but it's pretty good, and then we can describe the theory in terms of these structures, cells and organelles and the like. And then we wouldn't be talking about the type of the level of atoms and molecules anymore, we'd be talking at the level of cell biology. And that level sits on a lower level of atoms and molecules, of course it does. But it's vastly simpler to describe things that way. The dynamics of what's going on are vastly simplified. Now, in order to actually get a clue of what the hell's going on, it's also good. So this is a step forward. It's still impossibly ludicrously absurd. So with that, we carry on up. And then we identify inside that's going to be so maybe there's an intermediate step I'm missing here. But ultimately, we get to a stage where we're identifying not just patterns at the level of cells and things, but patterns at the level of whole organisms and organisms and behavior patterns. And then we're changing language again. And we're now using zoological language. We're talking about evolutionary adaptationism. We're referring not to electrons and molecules, not to cells, but to tigers and deer. And we're not talking about things like interaction probabilities and scattering coefficients. We're talking about things like camouflage and sort of behavior terms like hunger and sex drive and so on. Three is completely dependent structurally on two. Two is completely dependent structurally on one. And with each step, in principle, we lose a certain amount of accuracy, because in principle, the assumptions we make for going from 1 to 2, 2 to 3, could go wrong. There's a bit of noise going on. There's a possibility that something would fail. Even the microphysical dynamics are exactly right. The approximated assumptions we use to justify the next level of dynamics could be wrong somewhere. But it's pretty damn robust, and we can actually do it, and more importantly, we haven't done it, we can understand it. We have a fairly good idea of how. I believe we have a fairly good idea of how the hunting pattern behavior of large predators works. And our understanding of that is only very, very indirectly tied to what's going on at the ground level. So what's the moral to be drawn from this? The moral I think to draw from this is that higher level structure, macroscopic objects, should be understood as patterns, structures and patterns, which are instantiated in the microscopic state. So to be a macroscopic object is to be a certain pattern or structure in the lower level microscopic object. And what makes a certain pattern or structure real, rather than some sort of trick of the light, is its robustness and its explanatory and predictive usefulness and savings. We do need certain macroscopic objects that are patterns like tigers, davies, lecture feet. There are other completely random patterns you can just glue together from all sorts of weird, well, this pattern is instantiated given only in this atom is here and this atom is here and this other atom from the Andromeda galaxy is currently in a spin cluster one state. But those patterns don't really work, because they're just mathematical things to life. But the objects we see around us, the macroscopic stuff we use in our high-level theories and which we use in our ordinary life, are robust, useful development patterns about what they see. A slogan, a tiger, is a pattern of a case. Okay, so that's a theory to be told about what's going on when we look between states in science, when we between levels in science, when we look at a higher level in science and related to a lower level. Better plan left to go. So what's the time?
So
10 after 3. So here's the Gondel story. And this is pre-Mason problem for a moment. Consider, if you like, you're in a quantum state where everything maps off, basically. We haven't done all the weird special operations there. Just divisions. That's not true, of course, because there are always experiments going on outside the planet. We promise not to do it in perimeters. Okay, so still with me. Macroscopic objects, cats, apparatus, needles on dials, people, tigers, are patterns, and the thing that ultimately instantiates it, probably one or two things, are the position of the momentum is approximately localized quantum particles. So Gaussian wave packets describing approximately localized stuff. Probably not individual particles, but molecules. It's possible type of. But they're instantiated basically in quasi-classical possible quantum states. And they're basically, if you represent them, you look at the expectation values of positive operators that correspond to fuzzy approximations. If you look in that group, in that basis, that you'll see this pattern. And notice the important thing is not that we have to choose that basis. If you look at any basis that saw a useful pattern, then that's great for you. We didn't decide by stipulation, the tiger example, that we'll look in the following sort of cell patterns to see if it's a verified cell, say self existent. We just looked around and we found this pattern there and we found it's useful. So this is a pattern we notice in the observation, in what happens to be position mental observation operators. We could have found it something else. The dynamics of our world is such that we don't. Now, suppose we have two such patterns. Realized in different areas of one problem. Well, you can visualize the configuration space of this. So suppose I take a pattern corresponding to, say, a tiger in a certain quantum state. And I also consider the pure quantum state that corresponds to that plus what's the fact. And then I take a completely different quantum state that corresponds to tiger in a different state, plus its advanced quantum state, and I superpose them. Then what Deacon Jones tells us is that even as you evolve that system over time, both those patterns, as realized, will evolve happily and independently. Now notice that's not just a consequence of quantum linearity. The expectation value is a quadratic function, not a linear function.
Other degrees of freedom that are not in your hunting ground description?
Yeah, the atmosphere, let's say, or the fact of variation or something. Or if you like, they're in bits of my hunting ground scripts that I chose not to, I chose to sort of ignore because they weren't doing important work on something like that. You could need to get. So what we have here is a situation where if we take superposition if a tiger is a pattern in a certain quantum state, and I superpose that with another tiger pattern in a different quantum state, then I have two patterns. That's the problem. And we can see that in action. Let's consider an actual quantum state. Let's look at Schrödinger's cat. It's sort of David Gerd's Schrödinger's cat, it's some sort of interpretation, of course, as Stevie already did one scene. Have you talked about that? So quick revision, this is my setup. I've got some, what I think Schrödinger called a hellish device or something. And it begins in some state which we can label the initial state. At exactly 12 o'clock, say, we input some state into this system. Well, we can imagine the state from being there all the time, it doesn't get inputted till sort of 1 o'clock, and we don't need some outside agent to do this. Okay, the dynamics are here. If the input state has been up, then the device evolves into a release of cyanide gas state. And if the input is spin down, then the device evolves into a release catch state. So we put the device in the box with some cat, who presumably is not part of this. And there are several possible inputs. If we were to put in a spin out state, then we know, the main problem is not a worry, because we don't have a maximum position. Independent of the quantum mechanics, outcomes are different. If we input a down state, that comes alive and we run it at home. If we input any superposition, such as whatever it is from up plus down, the claim is that we don't get like that, we don't get dead cat, we get a weird superposition that we can make any sense of. So goes the story. But let's look at that from the framework I've just been advocating of how we should understand macroscopic torque of movement cats. There's a general lesson here, which is that I think it's a mistake to suppose that the right way of understanding some macroscopic object like a cat is to say there's a cat in orbital space and there's a subspace in cat in orbital space that means alive and a subspace that means dead. I mean, that's just a dangerous way of seeing naturally macroscopic ontology. I mean, it's obvious that a orbital space consisting of all the various atoms in the cat, but that orbital space is not a cat orbital space. You put those atoms together in all sorts of ways. So we have to look at what the stories tell about when states correspond to life cats and cats and what's going on. So suppose our input is definitely this. And let's look at that story. But let's start the story at, say, 11:30. So we've got some massively complicated swirl of atoms in the box, which we're sure is a cat. And in principle, we could do molecular dynamics to work out what happens to the cat state. And of course, that's completely impossible. But we could apply the language of animal physiology to make salient predictions such as, we could apply the lessons of, say, solid-state physics to predict that the cat will not spontaneously catch fire. We could apply, at a higher level, we can apply various issues of animal physiology to predict that it won't spontaneously grow two tails. We can use predictions of cat psychology to predict that it's very unlikely to start eating itself, it's really quite likely to fall asleep, etc. We can make an awful lot of informative statements about the about what's happening in the box. But the reason we can make those statements is because we're prepared to work at various higher levels of energy. This is right through science. No one ever thinks unless they're concentrating, that the whole of science can be done in the language of microphysics. So in understanding this cat situation, we are basically looking at certain instruction patterns which correspond to higher level cache down states of cats. And we are learning we may have to make informative statements about foxes. And it's because we can do that we regard the cat pattern as a real thing. In other words, it's because we can do that we say, in that box is a cat. Further, quantum interaction occurs. No quantum splitting because we put it in the state of the thing of measuring. Then microphysics predicts, let's suppose it's a large information process given to us a black hole, but even if it weren't, various higher levels of physics predict successively the apparatus splitting into this state, boiling gas being released, our theories of animal psychology predict cats will jump backwards, our predictions from physiology predict the cats will drop dead and due to awful stuff. We've got stories. We put in a down state, it's going to be very similar, although a less tragic story. The sign of weight relief, cat food to go out, eat it. Why do we predict that? Because it's part of our theory of cat psychology, same like so they can go for it. We've got some cash down analysis of cats doing eating, so very formal with their cat capturing with physical examination of cats, etc. We can kind of say these very informative things. And for that reason, again, we're going to say these patterns are real things. There really is a cat present, and what makes that macro state true is a certain structure present of the microscope. Right. So what about superposition? Let's say that first pattern is cat 1, and the second pattern is cat 2. Now, of course, the pattern is not really just the pattern in this formalism, the pattern in the quantum state is not just the pattern of the cat, it's the pattern of a reasonably large chunk of the entire world, because very small interactions flow out of the box, so that people might look at the cat for all we know, and place all sorts of structural positions on the environment spreading out of the box. So cat 1 is shorthand for classical world in which cats observed. So if there was if we put in spin up, we'd have no worry to say, no measure problem, we just say it's classical world where the cats are, where the cats are dead, and that's represented as a certain cat. If we input spin down, ditto, except the cat is alive. If we input up plus down, then we have both states present, both patterns instantiated. Each pattern evolves without interference with the other pattern, because the coherence of light's position relative basis in which the cat pattern is picked out. We don't have a weird superposition, we just have two patterns. And we already have a criterion for the reality of macroscopic objects, which say this pattern is a live cat. And we have a criterion for macroscopic objects that says this pattern is a dead cat. Apply that criterion to the whole thing, and we just say there are two cats present. they're present, representing different chunks of quantum state, but they're both there. So our superposition has moved not into a weird superposition, just into a state which has two cats. And this is up to set. And this is the sense in which we have multiplicity. It's not multiplicity of energy or other quantities, it's multiplicity of structure. The amount of structure in the world, which no one ever thought is observed, goes up. We have a chunk of, we have a chunk of structure here, that splits a chunk here, a chunk here. This chunk of structure has all the properties which lead us to regard that structure as instantiating a macroscopic world, and so does this one, which gives us many worlds getting this lesson.
Okay, so it sort of seems like your cat box is biased towards the equilibrium spaces. Because you're describing your input state as a superposition of states in your equilibrium spaces, and box does things based on a measurement in that basis. What if you had a box which did a measurement not in that equilibrium basis? Then you wouldn't be able to separate when you separate your worlds according to the equilibrium spaces or something like that, then it's not like dead cat, live cat.
Okay. Well, the box isn't exactly in the DKM space. The input box is a micro state. There's no such thing as a DKM space at the micro level. So you want to say, what about if I build a box that goes into state one, if it sees spin up, and state two, if it gets spin down, where states one and two are not in the DKM spaces. In the DKM. It works. You can't wait to find that's what DKM is. Before you set that thing up, before even the interaction has got very far out for the little bit of the box which is happening, then you'll get DKM, and the box won't be doing that. You can't build structures off the DKM spaces except at a very, very small level. And that's why quantum computation is so hard. I mean, it's the environment for DKM.
I'm confused as to why you can assume that there are these two cats won't interfere with each other because of the coherence. Usually we assume that there's a coherence because there's some interaction with the environment, which we're not taking into account, and therefore we trace out and there's a coherence. But in the cat experiment, we usually assume that there's absolutely no interaction between the box with the cat with the outside world until we actually open the box, in which case, well, we'll either see a dead cat or a live cat. But before we interact with the box, isn't there supposed to be no decoherence, and therefore there is this coherent superposition and it could potentially interfere with each other?
Well, two answers. One of them is that if that's how you want to build your Schrodinger cat box, then I feel relaxed that deserves my answer to give it to you. I mean, it's just not possible. You can't build a box to do that. I mean, if nothing else, you can't screen that gravity. Secondly, if you want to do that, then there are lots of, the level we're analysing, even to do quite low-level macroscopic torque in a box, very coarse grain respect to a quantum basis, because there are a lot of degrees of freedom in that box we're not looking at. There are plenty of internal environments out there that's used for one, so the cat can just decohere respect to that. We'll still see that structure present, and decoherence will still guarantee. It's a split box into a Hilbert space, H1, which is the same degrees of freedom we're interested in, cross H2, which is the environment stuff. Then H1 will decohere respect to H2. In H1, we'll have proximal position momentum localization, proximal position momentum decoherence spaces. We'll have a lot of structures that behave. We'll have this box H1 will be the place at which the cat pattern is instantiated. I put the two patterns there, and because of this box, they evolve independently. You can, in principle, do very clever interference experiments, of course, on the whole box, but the design of all these things together and break the coherence rule. In principle, we do such experiments in the whole universe, in fact, not the life.
If you can treat that outcome as the outcome superposition of being simple, what stops you from doing that to the particle? Like, for example, just go up or down to the particle. What point does the split actually have? Bring in a superposition of being particle.
Well, essentially because if you do that, you've got a product of spin up plus spin down across this stuff here. This stuff being a classical lab. Now, you could, if you wanted to, write both those things down. But firstly, if you actually look at the configuration space, the representation, well, sorry, I'm not going to answer the question about that. Let me start again. I think the right thing to say would be that if you just look at cat degrees of freedom and you ignore the particle, then of course you're going to have the present. If you introduce this extra stuff and look in that basis, you have got two cats present, notionally, but not usefully. Now, my criterion for regarding some notionally present pattern as being something to take seriously, not some sort of mathematical trick of the light, well, it was notionally useful. This one isn't. It's purely multiplier, say, for it. Yeah, if you decide to treat the state as up cross the initial cap plus down cross the initial cap. The initial cap thing is identical. We're just actually exploiting the outer space to make them look as if they're separate things. But the two caps are behaving the same way. These the notion of two caps.
In the microscopic situation where you have some position of spin, where you can see small bands where you allow the interference effects to allow us to those two states, how do you handle that situation in your relationship? Do you consider those two states to be some multiplicity of two separate worlds, and those worlds can actually still interfere with each other? Or
One strategy is you might say, metaphorically, although the only worlds that are interesting are the ones we get out of we do this sort of decoherence analysis, the only ones that are sort of macroscopic worlds, nonetheless, if we like, we could describe any base we like in principle as being the world for each other, and we could handle the multiplicity there by saying it's rather like, because then it's basically a different way to describe the situation. But we'd want to say it's principle, what's really going to respond to say. Or we can just refuse the problem. We can just say, well, interpretation, what we've got is a weird non-classical state. I don't think there's an obligational interpretation to deny the fact that microscopic world might be weird. And there might be no natural description of what's going on at the microscopic level in words, in sort of terminology that fits our classical description. So it might just be all you can say about it, it's a property position of these observable, but a different property position of these observable than what it really is, just this state here.
So you're saying there's two different things in the premise of that. The second option was Microsoft stages are possibly understandable.
That'd be
the state of the front plus down is just some physical state, singular world. Or you could go and say that actually Microsoft's positions are occupied set of worlds. But then you have to have some caveat where those worlds can interfere.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be using world in different ways, basically. The sense of world I'm using here is a macroscopic pattern defined notion. You could, in addition, say that you could do a different notion of world. Call the first sort of world branch, and call the second sort of world sort of world. You could say that what's really solving the measure problem for us is the dividing of the universe into these different branches, defined macroscopically by the pattern structure. But that on the microscopic level, it's still legitimate and wants you to regard any superposition as breakdown into worlds. But that wouldn't regard them as interacting with theory. But that wouldn't be. Wouldn't be part of your solution to the measurement problem, it would be part of your solution to what we're a different problem, which is the micro-ontology problem. What's the theory meaning for micro? You could also regard those two options not being very different and say that actually what the sense in which this micro world talk is true in the measurement. In the same way, against the text space, for example, we generally speaking don't regard any foliation based on having any foliation built in at all, but often we find to describe the theory of vision as if a foliation is practically necessary. More questions? A bit more said than last week.
What do you define, or how do you approach the problem? What do you define as what a macroscopic level is? What a macroscopic level is?
I think it's sort of related between what you're going to, you've got to complete the ethics, and you've identified within the ethics the fact that. The theory will contain a lot of structures, the structure of it, puzzle structure, have a structure of the macro world. We don't like fuzz because the fuzz is ubiquitous in art at a higher level, but there's always a bit of fuzz when you go for a level at a higher level. So, and this is a general feature of the epic interpretation, in fact, and I claim it's a general feature of the relationship between levels and science, and the epic interpretation just brings it out rather sharply. Things will be very well defined for theory, but they won't be precise. The point at which measurement occurs will be damn well defined. You hear this is a very fast process, they will not be completely. There'll be a fuzzy feature where there isn't much to say. And the timescale of the fuzzy feature, what's important is they're very short compared to the timescales which is useful and meaningful to talk about.
Is this really only what's in quantum mechanics? That there are patterns and that there is a macroscopic world that behaves in a different way? Is that is not an additional thing that you're bringing in? Because if I... Can't I do the same thing with the Copenhagen interpretation or with measurement? If I'm allowed to bring in the classical world, my problems are not quite the same.
I'm not sure I see how it's been brought in. I mean, to take an analogy, I mean, molecular biologists in the last century claimed that they explained that that they'd shown one didn't need to introduce life as an additional postulate to their theory, to something that was emergent. And the way they showed it was they started by knowing we all said this thing called life was, and they just basically showed that it was structurally there. I mean, stuff they'd already put together, no additional rules were needed. And it seems to be an analogy. Well, sure, to see them, to check, what we want to check is why we in fact see a macroscopic world. So we check whether there are structural things in theory that are well shaped. It's not that we take it, it's not that some alien from the universe comes along and just magically digs it out, but it's not actually initial structure.
You can, you're allowing yourself to tell when the pattern is a crack and when it's a buffy ball, right? So you're putting in the division between the classical and the quantum.
It is. I mean, the division in science being made here is going to be made by when the description of a certain level useful. So is there a useful passage in the probably not. Is there a description of higher level of quantum mechanics, sort of semi-classical? I suspect probably not. Yeah.
But if you did the same experiment instead of passing a buckyball, balls, and that was before Zeilinger did his experiments, right?
Yeah.
And then you would guess that buckyballs are patterns that should behave like cats.
Well, then I'd make a mistake, because I would have underestimated the ingenuity of experimentalists. I would have thought that it wasn't possible to do a superposition of all these things back together. Now, so two responses here. Firstly, of course, it's possible that we're underestimating the amazing experimentalist abilities in the future, and we'll be able to do cat superpositions. I'd be prepared to get my life. Well, possibly possible. But in addition, even if that is the case, that would just say there'll come a point when we bring these things back together again, where it'll stop being useful to talk about these microscopic structures, because the thing that made it useful to talk about will stop being valid. So say, for the sake of argument, suppose we ran the Schrodinger cat experiment, we've got a cat situation. 10 years later, God comes along, does the most amazing interest we've seen, and brings the branches back together. Then all you'd be saying is that basically is that the macro story you could tell would be, there was a cat, it branched from a live cat and dead cat, it exists for 10 years, then it ceased to exist. Then that's the structure that was it was disrupted, not merely changed in some way where we could track it from one to another, like happened when things ordinarily evolved, but it would be disrupted and destroyed. That would be the end.
So there are many world interpretations. So it's not, it doesn't, I guess, it's not, in a sentence, it's not exactly a theory by itself, but just a way of interpreting the facts.
Yes.
But it's still, can we falsify? Can we say, can we actually make an experiment to say we can prove that there are no more worlds being created? Or perhaps there's a negative prediction we can share we can set up some natural experiment in which we'll actually be able to detect.
When you're testing a theory, you always have to ask what you're testing against. Now, if you look at the framework I was arguing in this case for interpretation of quantum mechanics at the beginning, then you can test quantum mechanics, you can test the other interpretation against the theories I call type 1 and type 2. So you can test it against a theory that says, we'll change the dynamics of the world. We'll introduce new things. Because the quantum mechanics will say, so the other interpretation will say the predictions are exactly the same as our quantum algorithm gives us. Quantum algorithm being basically treat the wave function as a physical thing until it collapses and just change how you think about it. It won't give you any different predictions from the ones that treat the wave function as a state of knowledge. So the way you approach epistemology from something like this, if you're happy to regard your theories now, that is, you're happy to regard your theory as basically a box into which you've exposed it from now, then you didn't need to get closing interpretation game anyway. The existing quantum mechanics work fine. That's generally not deemed a central way to proceed, partly because it just doesn't seem to answer questions you'd like for an answer to. More pragmatically, because generally it's been a bad way to advance science. As a rule, we tend to advance things because we have theory of the world when we look at how it fits the world we change. We don't generally, the sort of model of a theory is an experimental algorithm. It tends to be something people come up with sort of on their days off. It's not actually, I think, okay, so that's the first sort of point which you get off the interpretation. You might say, well, I'm not interested in interpretation. If you are interested in interpretation, you have to say, will my theory be an interpretation of quantum mechanics, as you say, to test the structure of God, or will it be a new theory? And obviously you can test all the interpretations of quantum mechanics against these things. So then if you suppose your theory passes all those tests, you know it is a pure interpretation. So then the only options of pure interpretation, I'd argue, are the ones which is wave function is real and the ones which is not. Claim that the latter set don't make sense. If you think they make sense, if you think it's coherent and meaningful, talk about wave function as some sort of information theoretic entity or some solvable that comes without a black theory. Then I think if you go in that situation, I don't think you've got the interpretation. If you don't think that makes sense, then your space of options is somewhat limited. So the sensitivity test is rather indirect. It claims to be the only candidate for an interpretation that will not falsify quantum. It claims to be provably the only way you can make sense of quantum mechanics without making something into quantum mechanics, doesn't it? That's how the story is basically. Oh, sorry, I should land. You can also possibly have a theory that was structurally different, like maybe with the Bell theory, that was in principle distinguishable from it. I think the lesson of the history of science is that you can construct a situation like theory than death in practice.
For our input of the superposition particle, can we bring this thing back a step and say that we have no weird superposition of up and down, but just two states in two different universes of the input particle?
Well, you can if you want to, but if you go to that stage, you'll lose the justification of that in terms of high-level ontology, high-level structure that I was using before. You'll lose your pattern just for doing it. So it'll just become a metaphor and sort of go to the
other.
Okay, so then the last thing I want to say is just very quickly, before we come up to problem on Thursday, I want very quickly to talk about the question of how we should understand ourselves or stuff like that, which touches on your question. So where do we fit in this picture? Well, claim. People, including the brains of people, are macroscopic objects of the same sort, basically the same sort of status as any other sort of macroscopic system. Our behaviour, our actions, our brains, our lungs, and so forth, are complicated structures like any other complicated structure. If you don't believe that, if you think that there's something magical or at least fundamentally not understood at the level of macroscopic physics about the mind, if you think that if you think, for instance, you can have structures that structure the same as our brain, but don't become conscious, believe in that sort of thing, get off the other interpretation they used to. The other interpretation committed to the fact that human agents are just another sort of complicated system. If there's such a complicated system, I'm not going to ask that claim of anything else. Well, firstly, I have to say one way or another, secondly, it's way off topic, but a lot of issues, of course, with the position. But on that basis, we're a complicated structure. Throw us at the Schrodinger cat experiment, and let's suppose it could be we don't die because that's complicated matters. Let's suppose that it's just an observation. I observed it after I observed it. So here's me. I'm some complicated structure. I've actually observed this after the medical theory predicts that afterwards there'll be two structures of the same entity, except that one of them is evolving into the observing spin-up state, and one of them is evolving into the observing spin-down state. So what should my attitude be to those two structures? Well, firstly, is each of those structures legitimately a future version of me? Answer, yes. Because what makes a certain structure a future version of me? Answer, it's somehow sort of causally connected to me in the right way. It's evolved from my physical state. Because there's a certain sort of set of causal structure relations, which is quite hard to define explicitly, but that just make me now the same person, sort of future version of the me who started this lecture, even in the absence of it. And whatever those structures are, they're present in the absence of fission, they're present in the presence of fission. So both of those Davids have a justification to be called a future version of me. It just happens, though, too. Should I expect to experience both their experiences? No. Why? Because my experiences are, I'm assuming, structural properties of my brain. I've got a structure here, which is the same as my brain, it's having the same experiences. I've got a structure here, the other branch, also the same as my brain, having the same experiences. Can they share experiences? No. Why? The coherence. There's no space for interference between the branches can't talk to each other. Therefore, if we believe that people are physical systems, then the only thing to expect is that the one person performed measurement is now two people after measurement. And if it makes sense, does it make sense for me to say they are me? well, does it make sense for me to say I'm the same person who walked out of the room in 5 minutes time? We're not, it's difficult philosophically to understand how it makes sense to say that, but we do say it. And whatever the reasons are, they're going to apply the same way. So I should regard these future people as being me. How do I handle the two of me? Well, there are various ways of how to think about that, but a sort of practically simple means to explain what would be something like this. My actions in an ordinary classical world, well, thought it was ordinary classical, were basically designed to advance, assuming I'm entirely selfish, just for me, to advance the interests of me for me to through broader, with me and my various future selves, just in ordinary things, not normal things. So in a branching situation, I've got just as much reason to care about these multiple descendants as I have to care about my single descendants. So my actions are going to be set up in such a way as to advance the interests of the me's in the various branches. And in some situations, the interests of the me's in the various branches are going to conflict. And a simple example of that would be if I wanted to bet on the result of the academic experiment. If I wanted to bet on the result of the academic experiment, I choose which bet I make for the experiment, and according to whatever I choose now, one of my successes wins and the other one loses. So the interests of my successes are in conflict, and somehow I've got to weigh those interests up. And that gives you a qualitative framework, because you can see how, if you wanted to do that, you might well end up doing it by some sort of weighting of the branches in some way, who did what way, which would structurally look as if I was assigning a probability to the branches in the sense that I'd be behaving in the same way as I would just with blood loss probability. If I said this, if I decided to give this leap, you'd say there's some future versions get one result, some future versions get another result, I might well decide to say I'm going to weight these future versions higher than these future versions, so I'll prioritize their interest. Or I would weight these versions a bit higher than these versions, but these versions stand to be the big time. If I take certain forms of action, these guys won't be there at all, so I'll take certain forms of action. So you can see how it might be rational or not mad to behave in a way in a quantum world that was equivalent to putting some sort of probabilities on these future versions. Why should those probabilities have the faintest thing to do with the amplitudes? That's the system.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
You stated earlier that this idea of branching into different worlds, you didn't want it to be an extra postulate that has to be added to the theory, or somehow sometimes some sort of extra structure that has to be added to the theory. There is good reasons to convince the areas and reasons to do with the deep coherence spaces being vague and details and so on. So because of that, you've been arguing quite strenuously that the wave function we can see this sort of branching process and also classicality in it without having to postulate anything extra. And the argument is to do with patterns and structure. And so as far as I understand it, the idea is that if something is real and it has the same structure or pattern as a tiger, then it's a tiger. And then if we just look at the wave function, like write it down and look at it, then we see patterns of tigers in the, and because of decoherence, they persist in time. And therefore, they are tigers. So a lot of work is being done by this concept of structure. That's it. So my concern is to do with whether we can see structural pattern everywhere. You write them down in the right way. It's too much of it. Let me try and give an example. If we have a rope, say, which is secured at both ends, and it's just oscillating up and down in a standing wave, the simplest way to describe the rope is standing wave. If I wanted to, I could write down a really weird sort of superposition of different waves, which amounts to the same thing, but some of them are cat-shaped and some of them are dog-shaped and all sorts going on. I don't want to say that just because of that structure there, in that way of writing it down, I don't want to commit myself to saying that to cats and dogs, to see if I'm really right there is a word going up and down.
Yeah. So what's the difference here?
Yes.
Okay, I'll keep the slide. I don't have the slide. Okay, The criteria for doing the work in my definition was that to actually be called a real pattern, the pattern's got to do some work. It's got to have some sort of, it's got to be doing explanatory bits of pattern. It's got to bring something into the to our description of what's going on, which wasn't there without it. So the reason we accept the cat, the tiger cat, sorry, hunting graph, for instance, is the fact they fit into this high-level theory. It's their sort of the theory term in, well, in zoology, I suppose, different chunks of zoology. And they're doing work within that. Now, the cat and dog patterns, I mean, as you can look for some example, they don't actually, there's no structural advantage in some of the theory that way. But you don't get by considering that. Just the visual aspect. So that, I mean, that's where the sort of chunk of work is coming in. I mean, take another example. You might suppose, well, there are two sorts of tigers. One sort of tiger has an equal and even number of molecules in its body, and the other sort has an odd number of molecules in its body. Now, I suppose technically you could divide patterns off that. Like, you wouldn't want to regard those as being very higher level terms. You know, they're not terms you put into a higher level theory because they're good users. Oh, sorry.
Just wanted to make sure that I understood what you're stating here correctly, and the answer to previous questions. It seems to me that you're defining macroscopic reality as emerging from the coherence. Any system that will not interfere with itself in superpositions because of the coherence can be said to have has certain structures. For example, a cat can be macro. It will be part of macroscopic reality. And any structure, say, spin one half the hydrogen atom that can interfere with itself, with the superpositions of itself, is not part of this microscopic reality.
I think that's okay. And not fully sure what we're getting at, but that sounds right, yeah.
What about, say, something like a quantum? Well, if we believe Ray LaFleur in 20 years, we have quantum computers, which will be, in size at least, almost macroscopic. And by definition, they'll have states, they'll evolve into states that can interfere with each other.
Yeah.
Is that part of macroscopic reality?
What do you
want to
say
that? Not?
Okay, well, I mean, quickly, I don't want to say that an electron is not part of macroscopic reality. Electrons are there. What I want to talk about is the extent to which you're associating multiple bits of electrons together. So we're going to take a quantum computer. There'll always be something we can say about it, which is that the whole damn computer is part of our single macroscopic reality. But its internal state is going to be in some weird superposed. Now it might be, depending on the algorithm you're running, that you can run this same story locally. So suppose the algorithm does something, God, I'm very out of speed with my quantum computation, but if I remember, suppose the algorithm does something that looks rather like Shor's algorithm. So it puts some state in a superposition of a zillion possible inputs. It then runs a very protracted, essentially classical calculation on the bits, and then it brings them together. And from the perspective of that sort of algorithm, I think you can apply the same logic and say you have got separate computations happening in parallel, which you then bring together again, which is a way from George to talk about quantum computation. But other algorithms, some of the very groundbreaking, again, I like quantum computation, maybe massive algorithm, the algorithmic structure isn't anything like that, and there won't be a parallel universe story to tell about it. You'll just want to say it's a big complicated quantum state evolving, and the only useful thing you can say is it's in a superposition. I mean, there's no guarantee that any random way you can assemble the world will have this sort of thing coming out of it. I mean, you could take a cat and do it with a blender, and you wouldn't have coming out of any structure that was at the same sort of level analysis as a cat. These sort of things are risky, they sometimes turn out to the
day. You're looking at Hamiltonians of the universe. When we split, do you have new Hamiltonians that describe all the universes, or do they just describe one?
The single Hamiltonian of the whole universe is just carried on being there across all the branches. There's going to be a sort of effective Hamiltonian. Sometimes it will be more useful to use an effective Hamiltonian for the branch, which is sort of picking out dynamics in a way that you don't worry about it. So particularly, you might find you could simplify the Hamiltonian a lot, because there's a lot of terms in Hamiltonian that just aren't relevant to this chunk of this branch. But ultimately, the arbiter of whether you chose the right effect Hamiltonian is whether the dynamics are still what the true Hamiltonian is.
Okay, but the true Hamiltonian then does contain information in our universe about patterns on the other universes.
Well, the true Hamiltonian isn't in our universe, and the true Hamiltonian isn't anyway, it's an mathematical object. The true Hamiltonian is a statement, if you like, of dynamics of, I don't want to say the multiverse, the whole quantum state, reality. It's so confusing whether you want to use universe, world, to talk about the whole thing, the individual bits.
Sure. I believe you talked about the fact that you couldn't get new predictions out of the quantum mechanics out of the Everett interpretation, that it's called the mathematical structure.
Yeah.
Do you see the Everett interpretation providing new insights for other theories that would have predictions you can verify? If so, where do you see it from the same place, if not, what's the quantum interpretation?
Okay, answer that first. I'm in a philosophy class. The point of interpretations would be nice to know the world, because I think a lot of physicists share that too. Separately from that, pragmatically speaking, I think the main purpose of understanding it is it's relative form. So, okay, so partly thinking about the quantum state in certain ways gives you insight into how to do things with it. It's extremely contentious whether the right way to think about quantum computation, or even any quantum computation, is in many worlds. It's not contentious that David Deutsch, who sort of came up with some more of the first of these things, was inspired by that. So it's certainly not useful that way. But of course, something could be useful about being true. I mean, for all I know, there are great phobias ways of understanding how a certain quantum computation works, and we necessarily tell them that the moment I think it's true. So in terms of genuinely new physics, rather than understanding new things in our existing physics, well, speaking about science fiction, the main thing that strikes me being some relevance to is looking towards quantum reality, in the sense that if the measurement problem is not solvable within as an interpretation, it's a big crisis line for our physics, which means we have to, which means we have a serious need to replace our existing theory with a new theory to solve. And in that case, it would suggest that trying to quantize gravity by just conservatively applying sort of old quantum mechanical structures to general relativity is enormously risky as a strategy, because we don't even say that as an algorithm. And then you might well imagine that one was going to advance one's mathematical thought to solve the measurement problem, and one's thought to solve it from timing from gravity in parallel. If the Everett interpretation works conceptually, or to be fair, if another pure interpretation can make sense, then that pressure isn't there. I mean, the theory makes perfect sense internally, it's just it's not consistent with gravity. And then you might be more relaxed about taking approaches to quantum gravity, which leave the basic Hilbert space structure quantum mechanics alone, like the string theory approach or the space approach. But I mean, those are not to take this is kind of quite different from the
general. One last question.
I
just
want to
clear up how everything evolves in units. I'm not sure whether I tried on the point. You might talk about it when you do probabilities, but the many worlds is to get rid of the collapse postulate, basically.
Yeah.
Everything evolves unitarily.
Yeah.
So it evolves unitarily on the grand scale of looking at all the branches, because
yeah.
Nothing's ever collapsed. Is that how it gets out of the
yeah.
problem?
Yeah, it's unitary on the grand scale. It's not unitary. You could say it's unitary from a third person perspective. I don't see unitary dynamics, my theory tells me there's really unitary dynamics going on.
Can I thank our speaker again? Just to announce to the students, first of all, next Thursday when you come back for the second lecture, please don't leave any empty seats in the middle so we can pack everybody in. Second point, the webpage for the course is now uploading the content. You can get the lecture notes there, different projects, assignments, and so on. Thirdly, for those of you who haven't read the recommended reading for the many world sessions, please do so. It's listed on the
I think that's all of them.